Let me once again welcome you to this session, and the topic is addressing Europe's unresolved conflicts. As long as we have these unresolved or perhaps frozen conflicts, they will definitely hamper the political, economic and social developments in the regions close to us. Our ambition should be to analyze the present challenges and find out how to make an optimal use of the instruments and mechanisms at our disposal. And more specifically, we should look into how we can be helpful in moving these agendas forward. We'll have three speakers this morning. Adam Daniel Rotfeldt, the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Poland. It will be Boris Tarasyuk, Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Ukraine. Sergei Karaganov, Chairman of the Council for Foreign Defense Policy in the Russian Federation. And they will all have from 5 to 8 minutes to address the topics. And they will be followed by Antanas Valionis, the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Lithuania, Vladimir Sokol of the Jamestown Foundation, Giorgio Baramitsa, State Minister for European and Euro-Atlantic Integration, Georgia, and then Danfried, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs, United States, and they will all have from 3 to 5 minutes. And after that, I will open the floor for contributions from you. We have slightly less than 2 hours for this session. Mr. Jaroslav Skonieczka, who is a director for Euro-Atlantic Integration and Partnership Directorate, Political Affairs and Security Policy in NATO, will be the rapporteur of this session, and he will report during lunch. The first speaker is, as I said, Mr. Rotfeldt, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Poland. Adam, the floor is yours.
Well, I don't know whether I should...
You just
no,
talk
just.
And hope for the best.
Thank you very much, Jan. I would like to say that, in fact, it is for me not only an honor but pleasure to discuss, obviously, the issue. However, I have had once again a look on written notes I prepared, talking points, and since you said that it has to be 5 to 8 minutes, I decided, obviously, to put them aside and to present some main points, which will be preceded by two very brief anecdotes. The first one is connected with the fact that for many years director of the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, in 1999 I received an invitation from the Holy See for the private audience with Pope, and I was really very much excited. I didn't know what kind of issues could be discussed, how long, and I was informed in advance that it has not to be longer than 10 to 15 minutes. Later on, I have had a discussion with John Paul II, who mainly wanted to discuss the question of the conflicts. And he raised very basic question to me, saying that since Cyprus is dealing with conflicts for so many years, what in my view is a kind of the very basic explanation that we do have at the moment so many conflicts in the world and in Europe. I was not prepared, I would say, I said that everything what I can offer you as an answer will be very banal and maybe even trivial. In my view, conflicts are mainly caused by the situations where people are not only frustrated, but they are desperated by the lack of instruments or other way to solve the conflicts. In other words, in my view, the conflicts are mainly in the countries which are very poor. When people do not have any perspectives, they are entering into conflicts. And Pope listened to me and said, yes, to a great extent you are right, but in fact, I will tell you that it is for me a problem that there are so many examples in the history that poverty was even deeper for centuries, and people were living in peaceful way, they were neighbors, and suddenly it is a kind of the explosion of the conflict. When I left him, because I'm not going to discuss, because the discussion was not for 10 minutes, but almost for 1 hour, and my intention is only to say that the conclusion of this very brief presentation was that I raised the question for myself, what he wanted to make me, what kind of message he wanted to offer me. And it seems to me that his main intention was to say that in addition to everything what is rational, we have to understand that there are a lot of the irrational elements which are very difficult to define. And in other words, it could be evil, which is, I would say, an immanent element of the nature of human beings, but it could be, I would say, something what is very difficult to understand. The second anecdote is connected with the fact that SIPRI, as the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, was established to commemorate 150th anniversary of unbroken peace of Sweden. And being director, after 5 years, I decided to prepare a kind of the history of SIPRI, and I wanted to know how people did come to the idea to make such an investment, which in my view is a very good investment. And I noticed that for the first 100th anniversary, in other words, in 1914, before the First World War, it was also such an idea to do something to commemorate 100th of peace between Sweden and Norway. And two parliaments took a decision to erect a monument in Eide, for this very wise decision, and on Norwegian side, many politicians participated in the ceremony, but on Swedish side, nobody participated, and Sweden did not pay even 1 crown for this monument. 50 years after, in 150th anniversary, after two world wars, Sweden decided to invest millions, and Institute is a kind of the living memory of that concept that one should try to find the peaceful solution for conflicts. And in my view, the conclusion of that change in Swedish mentality is very much connected with the experience of two great wars. That after two great wars, people in Sweden changed their understanding of what happened in previous years, because in 1914 they have had a perception that independent Norway, or to say it in different way, the lost war for Sweden, it was a shame. But in my view, I would say now, I would like to come to the main issue of very brief presentation, is the following, that today and yesterday we spoke a lot about the new nature of conflicts, and this new nature is very much connected with the new security environment. Very often all of us, we are repeating new security environment, and in fact all of us, we have quite different understanding. For many, and for myself, it is first of all the collapse of bipolar system and a need to elaborate the new conceptual framework for security in the world. And this new conceptual framework means that there is a need to think how international community should react for the developments within the countries, not between them. And I would like to say that, in my view, this is the main problem, because the concept of the sovereign nations is, I would say, developed for centuries, especially in the 19th century, and in fact, to great extent, nationalism, deep-rooted national interests, they were, I would say, the collision between different type of national interests, they generated a lot of conflicts. There is no need to say that conflicts are multidimensional: political, ethnic, religious, national, social, economic. The problem is that international community does not have instruments how to deal with all these conflicts within the states. And I would like to say that my period in Cypri in that respect was, for me at least, very instructive, because I noticed that in recent 12 years, since 92, there were more than 60 major armed conflicts in the world. And only three of them were between the states: between India and Pakistan over Kashmir, between Eritrea and Ethiopia, and between Iraq and anti-Iraqi coalition. And I'm saying this that, in fact, most of the organizations are very well prepared to deal with external threat, not an internal one. And it is not my intention to say that one should ignore the nature of the present international, the contemporary international law, but one should be prepared, at least politically, if not legally, to new way of thinking. Because it seems to me that decisive is to find the way how international community could impose, I would say, the peaceful development within different states. And having said this, I would like to say that state under international law is composed of three factors: the territory, population, and control over territory and effective, efficient control over territory and population. The question, what kind of control, what kind of government, it is not defined within the present international law. Now we are very often saying that it has to be a democratic control. It has to be a kind of the state which is organized, having in mind, I would say, the rules of law as fundamental guidance. And now, speaking about all those frozen conflicts, and I'm coming to an end, I would like to say the following: that yesterday during this working dinner, Dmitry Rupel, as the chairman in office of the OSCE, said that in fact on the post-Soviet territory there are different type of conflicts. For example, it is question of Moldova, some conflicts in Georgia, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, at the moment Uzbekistan, not to mention Chechnya, and that all of them are different. All of them are different. And he's absolutely right that all conflicts as a rule are different, because I commented, I would say, in my reaction, I said that the first phrase of the Anna Karenina by Tolstoy is that only happy families are alike. The unhappy families are unhappy in their own ways. And the problem is always to find what is the reason of this unhappiness. And I would like to say that this is one of the questions which should be taken in a very serious way, that one should not try to create a kind of the common pattern, a model which is applicable to all the states. And my last point is addressed to the great powers. It seems to me that multinational institutions, multilateral organizations and structures like the United Nations, NATO, Euro-Atlantic Partnership Council, OSCE, European Union, but maybe not European Union is a kind of the different animal, because it is not an organization which is comparable to the others. Council of Europe, all of them, they have with different mandates, with different character, but what is in common? That for the great powers, multinational institutions, security structures especially, are important as long as they can be used as instruments to implement national strategies of great powers. But great powers, global powers, are not prepared to be instrumental for in multinational institutions if there is no need, if there is no interest. And it is, in my view, a very serious problem. What has to be done that for the United States, for France, for Germany, for Russia, and for the others, multinational institutions will be important instruments not only to implement their national strategies, but also to implement, I would say, the aims of the institution as such. In other words, how to change, I would say, their approach to this type of institutions. And I'm saying that, fortunately, for example, in my view, the element of the democratization in Ukraine brought us much closer to the new type of thinking. And since the next speaker will be Boris Tarasyuk, I would like to say that, in my view, what happened in Moldova after I have in mind the conflict in Transnistria, it reflects that democracy serves very well for the solution of for the peaceful solution of some conflicts which are freeze or suspended. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Adam, for your contribution, reminding us that all conflicts are different, and for your knowledge of Scandinavian history. I tell you that this very place was, am I not right, Delilah, was Norwegian up to the 17th century. Then you won, we lost, so you keep it. The next speaker is the foreign minister of Ukraine. Boris, the floor is yours.
Tusen takk. God morgen. Dear friends, I would like, first of all, to express the gratitude to the organizers of this very interesting format of our work, very informal one, of the EAPC. And what is especially important, that not only the representatives of official delegations are taking part in this format, but the representatives of NGO and of mass media, including my good friends from Ukraine. This is certainly a very good form of work, of brainstorming on specific issues. And to my mind, EAPC is a right forum for discussing this issue of frozen conflicts. And I think that the EAPC cannot be comfortable unless the time the frozen conflicts are not being settled. Why I'm concentrating on frozen conflict? Because there is no lack of attention to the conflicts in former Yugoslavia, in Balkans. At the same time, there was and there is a lack of attention, adequate attention, to the frozen conflicts on the territories of the former Soviet Union. The one in Moldova, Transnistria, the one in Abkhazia, Georgia, and another one in Nagorno-Karabakh in Azerbaijan. So all those conflicts, they deserve much greater attention from the EAPC than it used to be the case before. few words about the history of these frozen conflicts. from my point of view, we can speak about the origin of those conflicts as being instigated from the former center, guiding by the principles divide and rule. So this was the major reason and the major cause of those three conflicts I mentioned before. Another feature of those conflicts, that is the presence, the military presence in those conflicts, in all those three conflicts, under whatever pretext, be it so-called peacekeeping operation or whatever, but this military presence is a factor which is not helping to resolve the conflict, but rather to protract unresolution of those conflicts. I'm not talking about the usual, the normal peacekeeping operation conducted by the United Nations, by the OAC, or NATO-led operations. So, and those operations I'm referring to, they have nothing to do with the usual, normal peacekeeping operations. What is another feature of those conflicts? The origin of the conflicts was more or less similar. There was incitement from outside of the ethnic rifts between the different ethnic groups. So this was also something which was used. We in Ukraine successfully avoided, you know, any kind of this outside attempts to make a rift, to make a separation, well, concerning the situation in the Crimea. And if you remember, Ukraine was one of the examples of the country which avoided any troubles, any violence, not talking about the war, in settling the potentially explosive situation in the Crimea. Some people say that the inter-ethnic rifts are, the only reason of the emergence of conflicts inside of the country. But this is correct, but this is these are just some of the others reasons I referred to. One may speak about many cases the corrupt regimes are the main cause of the conflict. Thereafter follow many byproducts of the conflict, the organized crime, trafficking, acts of terrorism, smuggling, etc. And we in Ukraine feel a lot of these manifestations from the conflict we have at our neighborhood, I mean the Transnistrian conflict. The common feature of all frozen conflicts is that it is impossible to resolve any of them without the help and mediation of international community, be it the United Nations, OAC, European Union, NATO, or in this case EAPC, Council of Europe, or guarantor states like Russia and Ukraine are in Transnistria settlement. A few words about our experience Ukraine has accumulated in avoiding conflicts or helping to resolve the conflicts. The only realistic way of to resolve frozen conflicts, and this has been declared today by Laila Freivalds, that is by democratization, and by democratization of the territories. And in this regard, Ukraine can be helpful. With our partners, we have reinvigorated the role of GUAM, the regional institution embracing four countries of the region. And during the recent meeting in Chisinau, the presidents of four GUAM countries have decided to transform this institution into the full-fledged international organization. which strives to promote European democratic values in the region, encompassing the current frozen conflicts. Democracy, security and development are indispensable, and especially in the area of settlement of frozen conflicts. And not only security and development matters, but also democracy and development are matters. I remember one picture I've seen from the satellite of the Korean Peninsula. And there was a visible, the picture has been made at night, and there was a visible dividing line between the North Korea and South Korea, with South Korea full of lights and North Korea, you know, completely blackout. So this is a kind of visible picture of the correlation between democracy and development. So democracy matters a lot in terms of development. And in this regard, I would like to say that after the victory of democracy in Ukraine and in Georgia, both our countries established a kind of coalition democratic choice. And this has nothing to do with the structure or some organizational issues. This is the coalition is just the process. And the major objective of this process is to support democracy and to support democratic countries. We also are working in order to establish greater cooperativeness in the region through re-establish the Baltic and Black Sea cooperation process, reaching out to the Caspian. Participation of Russia in this process is sadly welcome and indispensable. Let me say a few words about Transnistria, which led me to some commonalities which could be followed in settling the conflicts. Recently, President Yushchenko put forward the concept of settlement in Transnistria being referred to as seven steps to settlement through democracy. What do we mean under this plan? We mean that the protection of rights of national minorities under the relevant OIC and Council of Europe instruments are very important in any kind of settlement. The building up of free media and developing institutes of civil society also are very important. Then the process of demilitarization of those territories and the introduction of international normal peacekeeping missions with appropriate mandate and with the wide participation of all interested parties. The holding of free and fair elections in all separatist enclaves under strict international monitoring. And recognition of these newly elected bodies is by no means recognition of the independence of these territories. These bodies will be recognized only as having mandate to negotiate with the central authorities the future status of territories within the borders of the respective states. And finally, the strict border and customs control by adjacent countries and with the participation of international community to prevent smuggling and trafficking. These are just a few words about our experience in tackling frozen conflicts. What can NATO and EAPC do in this regard? First, the EAPC can create an ad hoc working group on Europe's frozen conflicts. Second, the EAPC can elaborate a specific action plan to address challenges of Europe's frozen conflicts. Third, we may organize the discussion of Europe's frozen conflicts at the next EAPC Atlantic Policy Advisory Group meeting, which could be held in Ukraine. Number four, establishing NATO EAPC information center or liaison offices in the capitals of state facing frozen conflicts. And the last, establishing an informal NATO-Guam consultative forum to address the problems of frozen conflicts. I thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your contribution. And I'll give the floor to Sergei Karaganov. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have the privilege of an independent man speaking after two ministers who used to be independent men, but now are dependent on their official positions. But I adore, I greatly respect them, and they're really great friends. And I knew that they're also very good thinkers about the one of the few in Europe who could actually produce new ideas. So rather than arguing with them, which I could, I would add to their analysis. I mean, Boris is thinking that I am still plotting against him. I mean, no. I'm not. First, I mean, the name of our panel was renamed in terms of political correctness. It was called Frozen Conflicts. Now it is something else. But still, I mean, most of us have been talking about frozen conflicts, which is a very bad term, because the frozen conflicts means that they could be unfreezed and become real conflicts first. Clearly, in the North Atlantic space, these conflicts deal with the likes of Nagorno-Karabakh, Transnistria, Bosnia, Cyprus, Abkhazia, Ossetia, and of course Kosovo, which is the cause célèbre. These are the places in the North Atlantic community to which we all belong, or rather space, not community, space, which could be frozen conflicts or unresolved conflicts. Chechnya is a part of that list, but it is somewhat in a different category. It fought for semi-independence or quasi-independence. It was given independence. It used it for becoming a bandit's paradise. Then Russia had the will to suppress and eliminate this paradise of bandits and drug traffickers. But the price is known, and it is awful. So we have to have the Russian experience. Always, in front of us. Do we want to reproduce the experience? Maybe, but we have to know the price. The problem of unrecognized states is not a new phenomena. During the last 60 years, we have had, national liberation movements who shred their colonial powers and then created themselves into independent states due to the fact that that United States fought against the old colonial powers and Russia and Soviet Union fought against old colonial powers. And the combined efforts of the two rivals brought onto the world scene about 100 states which could not control their territory, could not produce the basic goods, being stability, education, health, stability, economic growth for their population. And now, I mean, United Nations are almost dominated by countries who are failed or failing, which is a very important issue to be thought about when we think about the unrecognized states on the territory of the former Soviet Union or former Yugoslavia. These states have created a habit of dependence, the philosophy of aid, which corrupts elites, and the philosophy of guilt, which is very strong outside of these nations. We were able to question the right of the nations for independence and statehood, even though these rights of nations were achieved in most cases by blood, mass murder, ethnic cleansing, and even outright genocide. Most of national liberation leaders and fighters were terrorists in the modern understanding of the term. So now I'm coming a bit more concrete to the burning issues of Europe. So 5 to 15 years has passed since these countries or these territories parted with their mother nations, to which they were with which they formerly belonged. We should always remember that these nations emerged, or territories emerged, as a result of the disintegration of two great multinational countries, one Yugoslavia and one the Russian Empire, Soviet Union. Most of these countries didn't have neither legitimacy and nor the right the historic right. However, I mean, many of the territories in these countries believe that they have the same right for independence as the countries to which they formerly belonged. And we are now dealing with the aftermath of the disintegration of the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia. It's unbelievable for me that the disintegration of the Soviet Union was so bloodless. I mean, relatively bloodless. But we have to look after. We lost in all these wars much less than in the national liberation wars in Yugoslavia. But 10 to 15 years passed. In most of these entities, new elites were formed, new historical mythologies were formed, new histories were formed, and new affinities, national identities were formed. In addition to that, elites, both in these separatist entities, as well as in mother countries, have developed some kind of a common interest in keeping the status quo for economic reasons. We all know about the illegal trade which is coming through Abkhazia or else from Transnistria, But we know that the profiteers are not only in Abkhazia and in Transnistria, but elsewhere, and the biggest profiteers of that. Now, we also know, and that is much more important, that in many of the countries which have these breakaway provinces, there were a political interest in keeping the status quo has been developed. You will remember that Mr. Shevardnadze has been keeping 300,000 refugees and not trying to domesticate them for almost 10 years. And that was an explanation why he failed to reform his country. And now we are willing to see that Georgian younger reformers could do away with his legacy. But these people are there. They were never domesticated. And that was the explanation for no reform and for unbelievable corruption. The same is happening in Moldova to a certain extent and in other countries. So, I mean, parallel interests were developed. So, what are the possible solutions? Status quo. Satisfactory, but not for long. Secondly, reunification by means of dialogue. We should be sure that we have to, that we have the stuff, and we have the will to impose that dialogue. A recognition of these countries as sovereign states. Why, for example, Georgia is a sovereign state and Abkhazia is not? Why Russia is a sovereign state and Georgia is a sovereign state? And Chechnya is not. I mean, I explain very simply. Russia has had the will to impose its will on Chechnya. I mean, these countries could not have the will or the power to impose their will on Chechnya. Recognition, reunification by force. We tried it. We know the price. A reunification by free will of peoples of unrecognized states. That could happen only through a very long process of negotiations and of development of the mother states. Because most of the mother states now are less developed or equally less developed than the unrecognized states, I mean. Georgia until very recently was, less developed than Abkhazia. I mean, hopefully it is getting better now. And we all wish, I mean, and nobody in his right mind would want to join a Georgia who used to be a failing state. Now, hopefully, it is not a failing state. It is a state which is getting out. The same goes for Moldova. The same goes for many other countries. International involvement. Russia has been, in terms of peacekeeping, has been the most effective. I'm sorry, I'm for the first time now, I'm becoming partisan. Before that, I was scholarly. Russia has been the best peacekeeper in the world. Let me remind you. Let me remind you that all of these conflicts were kept at least frozen or whatever, or kept. I mean, under control for almost 10 to 15 years. I mean, under control. People were not killing each other. And some of the conflicts, like in Tajikistan, were actually solved because we could have had, a forceful disintegration of Tajikistan. We solved that problem. But that is not an overall solution. So, and who should participate? in peacekeeping, reunification, etc. It's a big question. UN, by all means. European Union is telling us that it could involve Russia in dealing with these unresolved conflicts, which is weird, because European Union, with all my great respect, doesn't have any instruments as so far to play any kind of a role there. NATO has and probably will have. And Russia is not against international participation in this conflict. The question is, what do the other parties bring to this? Do they want simply to participate, or do they want to solve or freeze or unfreeze the conflict? Yeah. And I'm finishing. European Union was good in Macedonia, but it was a small issue, and it was effective in Cyprus, but for obvious reasons. OSCE is useful, but in a very limited way. So probably, after 10 years of, or 15 years of history of unrecognized states, we'll have to deal with that matter much more seriously in 2 or 3 years. Some of them should be recognized. Some of them should be put under some kind of international mandate. Some of them should be reunited. But we do not have a magic formula. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This completes a list of the three first speakers, and as you certainly know, I've not kept a very strict discipline, to put it that way. But to allow for all everyone to speak, perhaps I should remind ourselves that the discussions will be have from 3 to 5 minutes to comment on what has been said and introduce other points as well. So, now in the next group of speakers, the first speakers will be the Foreign Minister of Lithuania. Antanas, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, I am tired much more than my colleague Sergei, so I will try to speak more precisely. But I will start from saying that Lithuania is on the eastern border of NATO and the eastern border of European Union. And in this place, very different approaches are meeting. Lithuania, together with NATO, with the European Union, thinks that only democratic and free states in the neighborhood with market economy can increase security of Lithuania, of European Union, or of NATO. Sometimes I have imagination that in our neighborhood, especially in Russia, some people think that only extension of territory can guarantee security. And those different approaches sometimes meet each other in Ukraine, for example, in Moldova, and so on. And that is one of the problems we can resolve. I think it's the only way to extend democracy. The previous speakers have presented numerous insights into the causes, the effects and the instruments of addressing the frozen conflicts that still persist on our continent. And I would like to add a few words regarding more general factors contributing to more or less successful conflict resolution. Peace and stability in the Western Balkans is still an unfinished business, even though we see this region's future firmly anchored in Europe and the transatlantic community. Such international organizations as the United Nations, NATO, and the European Union do play a very important role in helping the Balkans to heal their wounds. But the factor of European and transatlantic integration seems to be crucial. The perspective of joining NATO and the European Union, supported by a wide range of so-called outreach instruments, has encouraged much-needed reforms and now serves as a magnet for those countries wishing to build a more certain and prosperous future. I am confident that a similar approach will be highly appreciated in other parts of Europe dealing with their unresolved conflicts. After the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, as well as consolidation of pro-European leadership in Moldova, the Transnistrian case seems to have high chance for a breakthrough. We expect that by further implementing democratic and market-oriented reforms, Moldova itself will accelerate the resolution process. A good deal of effort must also be shown on the Ukrainian side. We believe that Ukraine, which has declared its pro-European vocation, is genuinely interested in ensuring full control on the Ukraine-Moldova border, including its Transnistrian segment. And we urge the Ukrainian leadership to do so. Last week, President Adamkus met President Yushchenko in Vilnius, where they spent some time discussing this issue. I want to believe that the Ukrainian leadership will resist the enormous pressure put on it by various elements unwilling to give up the status quo. Last but not least, we must also ensure full implementation of the Istanbul commitments by Russia. It is striking sometimes how much we are focused on the negotiations, formats, rather than addressing the basic causes of instability. In Transnistria, we must help the parties to get rid of the major destabilizing factors before any long-term solution could be reached. And it's in doing this, we should insist on democratic values and provide a clear-cut perspective for those nations who want to follow this path. The Balkans' experience can also be applied to the South Caucasus. Instruments of cooperation can facilitate regional dialogue and cooperation, which are lacking in this region. The goals of our assistance and engagement in the South Caucasus should be to focus attention on such areas as implementing domestic reforms, introducing long-term strategic planning, strengthening democratic control of the armed forces, boosting democratic institutions. These focused efforts will, in the long run, have a positive influence on the peaceful resolution of regional problems. NATO already works hard in many of these areas. We know that effect of NATO's assistance from our own experience, and we are ready to provide advice. I encourage NATO member states to be even more visionary and flexible in responding to the individual needs of our partners and the partners themselves to be more proactive in making the best use of the instruments available to them. By successfully combining NATO's and EU instruments in the APC area, we will support and encourage painful yet necessary reforms, generate a socio-economic progress, and foster a stronger transatlantic perspective. This can, in the long run, warm up conditions for the resolution of frozen conflicts. good neighborly relations, political dialogue, and especially the ability to compromise, these are some of the keys to success that helped us on our way to NATO. I'm deeply convinced that such measures as the implementation of Membership Action Plan and the development of Vilnius 10 cooperation process have been the most effective means for promoting peace and stability in our continent. The recent Guam summit is an example of similar laudable regional cooperation, which I'm sure will develop further and will be encouraged by NATO and the EU. Higher the level of such cooperation, better the prospects for resolving seemingly insoluble conflicts in the region. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I now turn to Vladimir Sokor, who will be the next speaker. Please.
I have systematized my comments into six conceptual points, implying in each case a policy recommendation as well. First, interests. All of these conflicts are unfolding in the greater Black Sea region, an area where the Euro-Atlantic community has major interests. The area provides a strategic access corridor to operations areas in Central Asia, Afghanistan, and the Middle East for Allied forces. And it provides an energy transit corridor for Caspian oil and gas to European consumer countries. At stake is the energy independence of Europe in the future. This area is truly, paraphrasing Mackinder, the new pivot of history at this particular stage. Conflict settlement strategies should proceed from this premise. Two, international law. It is necessary to restore the operation of international law in this region. Since 1991, this region has been practically outside the purview of international law. Borders have been de facto shifted or erased. Foreign troops and bases are stationed in foreign countries without their consent. The principal offender against international law in the region is, of course, Russia and its military. Conflict settlement efforts need to proceed from solving this problem, the restoration of international law. Third, the democracy dimension of conflict settlement. Any political settlements of these conflicts, any solution to the political status of the secessionist areas, must be democratic solutions. The secessionist, at least three of the secessionist enclaves, Transnistria, Abkhazia, and South Ossetia, Karabakh being in some ways in a separate category, are characterized by a model of governance that involves a fusion of black and gray black and gray economy structures, the state apparatus, and the security services. Arriving at political settlements and political status determination with the incumbent leaderships would involve anti-democratic quick fixes. Political settlements need to be preceded by a transitional period of democracy and civil society building in the secessionist enclaves. Before any elections can take place, it is necessary to enable the populace of these areas to build NGOs, independent non-governmental organizations, political parties, free local media, and ensure their access to international information. Only after such a transitional period can legitimate and credible elections be held. Fourth, demilitarization. The secessionist enclaves are over-militarized. There are so-called peacekeeping forces provided by Russia, which are peacekeeping in all, which are anything but peacekeeping. There are the armed forces of the secessionist enclaves themselves, created through transfers of personnel and armaments from the Russian armed forces. There are the security services of the secessionist authorities. And finally, there are the so-called unaccounted for treaty-limited equipment, this wonderful linguistic creation of the OSCE, Those are heavy weaponry holdings that would have had to be scrapped or repatriated to Russia under the CFE treaty. Instead, they were handed over to secessionist forces. Before a viable political settlement can be discussed, let alone reached, the regions have to be demilitarized. And the peacekeeping model needs to be changed. Not only the areas, but the peacekeeping operations need to be demilitarized and civilianized. With the possible exception of Karabakh, where perhaps a strong military peacekeeping operation might be necessary in the events of a political agreement among the parties. But in Transnistria, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, there is no need for militarized peacekeeping. In 2003, the European Union developed, for a very short time, a peacekeeping concept involving predominantly civilian components, with only a token military component. It was proposed for Transnistria. It got nowhere because it was shut down within the European Union by certain West European governments. I think this two-year-old concept needs to be placed back on the table. Point number five, process. The current negotiating formats are, in fact, they belong not just to history, but to a prehistoric stage as seen from today's perspective. They date back to the early 1990s, when the enlargement of the European Union and NATO and the acquisition of major Western interest in this region would have been unthinkable more than a decade ago. In the meantime, Western interests have increased and exponentially and have outgrown the existing peacekeeping, the existing negotiating formats. Western institutions have essentially taken a hands-off approach to conflict settlement. In 2002, the NATO-Russia summit and the US-Russia summit, held back-to-back in May 2002 in Italy, envisaged joint efforts at peacekeeping and conflict settlement in the four frozen conflicts which were named, were specifically listed, Transnistria, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, Karabakh. Nothing was heard about that initiative since May 2002. The European Union, despite its great economic interest in the region, is practically an absentee in terms of conflict settlement. The European Union has taken the very easy approach of selecting special representatives who, in fact, exercise post-retirement sinecures in these regions. It is the case of Heike Talwiede and of Mr. Jakubowicz, of course. The EU is completely disengaged from these issues. About the OSCE, the less said, the better. The OSCE is being eviscerated from within by Russia. If the OSCE is to survive as a credible international organization, it has to abandon its ambition of being a security actor. The OSCE's competitive strength is in the field of democracy building, election monitoring, and the like. That's where I see a role for the OSCE in democracy building in the secessionist enclaves. Security should be left to more capable actors. And finally, last but by no means least, the sixth point, the role of Russia. Russia is the problem, not the solution in most of these cases. Russia's interests do need to be taken into account. Russia's voice needs to be taken into account, but as a voice in the debate, not as a veto on the process. We need to graduate from the stage in which we consider Russia a veto on the process and listen respectfully, but in a non-binding way, to Russia's view. In conclusion, the vision that should guide us, our efforts towards solving these problems, should be the vision of Euro-Atlantic enlargement. We should regard this area as the follow-up stage of Euro-Atlantic enlargement. And we should proceed from this premise in trying to solve these conflicts in accordance with Euro-Atlantic interests, not with the interests of the former imperial power. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we have a lot of points here to which we should discuss later. I think I'd go immediately now to...
Wait,
sorry.
Fred.
Yeah, no, immediately to Giorgio, then to Danfried, and then to the... My point was only that I think that you made it... I just watched the audiences and saw that they're taking note of a few points, so I think we'll have a lot of contributions in the debate afterwards. So, no, we are going to Georgi Baramidze for his contribution, and then to Danfried, and then I will throw it open to discussions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I have to say many thanks to the organizers for giving us this wonderful opportunity to come here and to have such a frank discussion. And I have to begin with the support to the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Ukraine, which has given us some ideas how we can, under the auspices of the EAPC, have established some institutions in order to deal with the unresolved conflicts, and we fully support that proposals. Speaking about Europe's unresolved conflicts and European security, most acute concerns are existing conflicts in Moldova and in South Caucasus, obviously. We've been speaking about this. We welcome Ukraine's constructive role in the Transnistria conflict resolution with the respect of territorial integrity of Moldova. And we welcome recent renewal of the talks between Azerbaijan and Armenia, and it was very promising dialogue between two presidents in Warsaw. So we hope this process will go on, and we will have serious progress in that regard. And Georgia is certainly interested to have a peace between Azerbaijan and Armenia and to have resolved the Karabakh issues. Beginning being lawless black holes and safe heaven for terrorism, smuggling, human trafficking, and other illegal activities, conflict zones represents a threat not only to the Black Sea region, but to the whole European security. Resolution of those conflicts required certainly joint efforts. Speaking about conflicts in Georgia, I would like to note current critical situation which cannot be tolerated. Russia is still not playing a constructive role, and I'm not surprised, because even such a distinguished intellectuals as Mr. Karaganov is questioning the issue of the territorial integrity of Georgia. If this is the case, if people like Mr. Karaganov is questioning territorial integrity of Georgia, of course, we are not surprised that Russian officials are not playing a constructive role in this process. Separatists are trying to keep status quo, and status quo is the following, that we have ethnic cleansing conducted, for instance, in Abkhazia. So what we are offering right now to agree with the consequences of ethnic cleansing, and ethnic cleansing is not our definition, is the OSCE the resolution, and they referred these resolutions in the UN many times. So I don't think that the world should tolerate ethnic cleansing in the 21st century. And CIS, actually, Russian peacekeepers are ineffective. And I have to remind my colleagues that more than 1,700 innocent civilians were killed during the so-called peacekeeping operation in Abkhazia. Georgian government is committed to peaceful resolution of the conflicts and has a clear vision of the process. We are trying to build confidence and activate dialogue. President Saakashvili's Strasbourg initiative offers a comprehensive plan of the peaceful conflict resolution. We are ready to compromise and offer any kind of security guarantees, any form of political and cultural autonomy, special tax and economic favorable measures. Our goal is to restore territorial integrity, protect human rights and rule of law on the whole territory of Georgia, of course, including South Ossetia and Abkhazia. We believe internationalization of the peacekeeping process will significantly contribute to the progress of the conflict resolutions. Here we see the necessity of more active engagement of the UN, OSCE, European Union, and particularly NATO. While resolving the conflicts, we are offering a win-win solution for any party involved, including Russia, including Abkhaz and Ossetians, our citizens. Everybody can be winner and will be winner when these conflicts will be resolved. Particular attention should be drawn first to the protection on human rights and elimination of the consequences of ethnic cleansing in Abkhazia, Georgia. Second, the return of the refugees and IDPs, regardless their nationality and political identity. Creation of the international police unit in Gali region of Abkhazia is very important. We believe timely and smooth withdrawal of the Russian military bases from Georgia territory will contribute to the conflict resolution. Finally, I would like to underline the peaceful conflict resolution and restoration of territorial integrity is adequately reflected in a Georgia's IPAP, which is our main path to NATO integration and will be also reflected to an action plan within European neighborhood policy. And the restoration of territorial integrity of Georgia will be tremendous impetus for modernization and democratization of our society. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much. And then now I turn to Dan Fried, who will be the last speaker in this part of the of our discussions.
First yours.
This has been a lively panel, and I am in the unfortunate position of following Vladimir Sokor, whose rhetorical flourishes, not to say substantive suggestions, I don't dare to follow. But very lively, Vladimir. There are two strategic contexts in which we're discussing the frozen conflicts, and these two have been referred to by other discussants. One is the emergence of the Black Sea region as a frontier for democratic and reformist impulses, which have been gaining strength over the past year and a half, and as a possible venue for accelerated Euro-Atlantic integration. That is one overall context. The second overall context is the possibility that we are witnessing in this region, but also in Central Asia, an acceleration of domestic political developments as societies become impatient and unwilling, impatient with and unwilling to tolerate misgovernance, corruption, authoritarian rule, and the resultant stagnation or deterioration of their well-being. I do not know whether what's happened in Uzbekistan or even Kyrgyzstan should be characterized in the same way that we have characterized the democratic advances in Ukraine and Georgia, but the reaction of populations to misgovernance seems to be something all of these areas have in common. If these two, if I have adequately described or accurately described the overall context, then we may face a situation in which the frozen conflicts will no longer remain frozen and merely the subject for mid-level government bureaucrats in the West and specialists to study. These may be unfreezing in ways which could be hopeful or very dangerous. If an acceleration of political developments constitutes a potential problem, it also could lead to potential solutions. Speaker after speaker today has identified democracy and reform within the region as one of the chief assets for those of us searching for solutions to these conflicts. To put it very concretely, a reformist, functional, higher-performing Georgian state is going to be obviously a more attractive magnet for the peoples of South Ossetia and Abkhazia than a Georgian state which is not functioning as well. A reformist Moldova, certain of its confident of its future with Europe, confident in its democratic and free market reforms, is going to be an attractive place for the people of Transnistria. These two factors should help frame our discussion. International organizations, whether the OSCE, NATO and the EAPC, and the EU, are going to have to get involved more actively in the search for solutions if we do not find ourselves forced to deal with the aftermath of conflicts, which may be the result if we fail. Our Russian colleague referred to Russian peacekeeping forces, I believe, as the best in the world, or certainly awfully good at having kept the peace in the frozen conflicts. I don't wish to look back and assess the role except to acknowledge that in many cases Russian peacekeeping forces did achieve certain things. But looking ahead, it is not enough merely to have kept the peace. The efforts and Russian efforts also need to be focused on achieving solutions. Throughout the region, we are seeing the beginnings of more serious discussions and more serious approaches to finding solutions, whether this is the useful contacts on Nagorno-Karabakh, a new set of Ukrainian proposals for Transnistria, and a new Ukrainian government, which seems to be taking a much more active role and very constructive role in seeking and contributing to a solution. President Saakashvili's autonomy offer for South Ossetia, which is clearly meant as an offer to be worked on and even expanded. All of this suggests that the mechanisms are available, the political will among some of the parties is there, and if the context is as I suggested, the time is now to move ahead. Two weeks ago and a day, President Bush was in Georgia. With respect to frozen conflicts, he made two points, one of which was peaceful solutions are the only ones which should be contemplated. Loose talk of war, restoring territorial integrity through force is not really a good approach. And secondly, that settlements need to be pursued with all energy. The relationship between reform, political acceleration in the region, and solution to frozen conflicts is something which I think is common to almost all the speakers today. It will be our task to take these elements and pursue solutions actively. That certainly will be the position of my government working with the governments represented here and some of the governments in the audience. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I know that quite a few of you would like now like to make a contribution. We just have 1.5 hour to go, and I know it's pretty difficult now to focus the discussion, but still I just want to suggest that please keep in mind that a lot of people now would really like to speak. The first speaker I have on my list is Sir Brian Fall, who will be the first speaker. To be followed by the ambassador from Macedonia, and I'll try to handle the rest. Do anyone have a microphone? I guess we need a microphone. Yeah, okay, got one. Yeah. Sir Brian Fall.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. The European Union contribution has been either ignored or described as weird. Thought I'd just say a word on the South Caucasus, where Britain is about to take over the presidency and the Union is clearly intent on becoming more active. The country reports will be succeeded by action plans, and we will have a much more concrete policy base. to the new European partnership. So this is work in progress, but it's work heading, I think, in a good direction. It will be based on the idea that there is no alternative to peaceful resolution. What Bush said in his visit to Georgia was extremely important and will have full support, I'm sure, from the European Union diplomacy. We would like to build on the idea of regional dialogue in the South Caucasus to the extent that it can be done, and that is longer term, but we need to make a start wherever it's possible to think in trans-border terms about what's needed. We need, I think, to make everybody more aware of the opportunity costs of non-settlement. And I don't think that civil society in each of the three countries in the South Caucasus is as aware as it should be of what is being lost by a failure to resolve. The cost of compromise is headline stuff. The opportunity cost of non-resolving is more difficult to bring out. And finally, a small but in human terms a very important point. Sergei Karaganov, I think you could have been a little more generous to the new Georgian government on the IDP issue, where the political change has already been enormous from Nade Rishvili to Alessania, and I think that the emphasis there, I hope from Russia as well as from others, will be on this returning refugees to the Gali district in the first place, which is what all the friends of the Secretary General and the Security Council are pressing. That will be hugely important in changing the political climate. And the final point, I think the EU view will certainly be that Russia is and must be encouraged to be a part of the solution. We do not see Russia purely in Sokorian terms. Thank you.
Mm. Yeah. Ambassador?
Bonjour, je parle en français. D'abord, je voudrais exprimer mes compliments pour l'extraordinaire organisation à nos hôtes suédois. Tous les orateurs ont utilisé plusieurs termes. On a parlé des conflits, conflits gelés, petits conflits. Donc, on a même mentionné la Macédoine. Je suis l'ambassadeur de Macédoine à l'OTAN. Puis, on a parlé de la crise et aussi de la présence des troupes étrangères, ou à savoir l'occupation. D'ici, il paraît qu'il sorte trois choses importantes. Que chaque crise est particulière, donc chaque conflit est particulier, et il faut une approche particulière. Deuxièmement, peut-être pour vous, c'est une question formelle, mais de chaque crise, il y a aussi des conséquences, à savoir, prenons l'intervention asymétrique de l'armée, ou les conséquences concernant le procès devant le tribunal à La Haye. Parce qu'il y a des débats, est-ce que c'était une occupation, est-ce que c'était une crise, est-ce que c'était un conflit. Concernant la Macédoine, on a parlé de la crise, une crise gérée d'une façon extraordinaire, d'abord par la présence des OSCE, de l'Union européenne et de l'OTAN. Donc, une approche, disons, multi-institutionnelle. Et deuxième chose très importante, la méthodologie interdisciplinaire. Peut-être je pourrais citer ce qu'il a dit ce matin le secrétaire général. Pour gérer la crise, la meilleure solution, bon, c'est dimension démocratique et démilitarisation, mais aussi une approche économique, sociale, politique et militaire. Peut-être on peut approcher, ajouter une approche aussi culturelle ou identitaire, surtout quand il s'agit de crises où il y a les entités qui sont de différentes natures religieuses, etc. Donc, pour conclure, nous avons vécu une expérience très positive de gérer la crise avec les éléments qui étaient mentionnés ce matin de la part du secrétaire général. Merci.
Thank you very much. I must apologize for not knowing the names, but I think I got most of you on my list, and I simply have to point. I have after the next speaker, I still have about nine speakers, and I guess I missed some. So please keep that in mind. But now, sir, it's your turn. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me? My name is Urban Ahlin, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in Swedish Parliament, and I have one statement and one question. And the first statement is to Sergei Karaganov, because I didn't understand the logic when you said that the Chechen conflict should be put in another category than the other unsolved conflicts, because the fight in Chechnya was about independence. And in my opinion, the conflict in Kosovo or in Transnistrian conflict or in Cyprus is also about independence. I can't see really the logic behind that. The question to the panel is based upon what the Lithuanian foreign minister said, that we all share the same dreams and the same values of living in a society with free market economy, social welfare, democracy, and so on. And isn't the simple truth about this that we have been very successful in the European Union and in NATO in enlarging to countries, helping them in reforming, because they have had a driving force, a carrot, in becoming a member of NATO or European Union in the future. And because of that, they have had this driving force to make reforms and democratize the countries and so on. And we have been so successful, so the European Union and the NATO has now enlarged until a situation where we come so close to those frozen conflicts or unresolved conflicts. So we reach an area which I call a common neighborhood with the Russian Federation. And here is my point. I have visited a lot of elections, being election observers. And I must say, I'm frustrated, I'm puzzled by standing in a polling station in Belarus or in Ukraine, see obvious fraud, standing next to a Russian colleague, seeing the same thing. But afterwards, when we are delivering our statement on the election, I say that we saw irregularities, it was not dealt with in a good order, and it was a lot of fraud here. And my Russian colleague, which was in the same polling station, says everything was очень хорошо. Everything was very good. And for me, this is puzzling. How can it be like that? We are in the same polling station looking at the same thing. And in my view, we need to go ahead and say, what's the problem with democracy, market economy, social reforms in this area? Is there any country in this region that is actually not benefiting from it? It's good for us in the European Union, it strengthens our security, it's good for the people in the region, and it's also good for the Russian Federation. And in my view, the problem is that there are great powers inside the European Union and NATO that is more keen on having a bilateral relationship with the Russian Federation, and by that overlooking the frozen conflict in this region. And that must stop. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister from Moldova.
The recent parliamentary elections provided for a political climate that is extremely favorable for achieving Moldova's strategic objective of European integration and enhancing cooperation with Euro-Atlantic structures. All the parliamentary factions have committed to work together in order to bring Moldova closer to the European Union, to promoting a common position for the peaceful settlement of the Transnistrian conflict, strengthening democratic institution. Cooperation with NATO is the best way in which Moldova can join the efforts of the international community and construct a common system of Euro-Atlantic stability and security. The problem of separatism in the Republic of Moldova regrettably became one of the frozen conflicts in Europe and continues to remain an extremely negative phenomenon, which undermines the system of stability and security in Europe. In fact, we are talking about a conflict followed by neo-imperialistic interests, entangled with those of the mafia-type separatist clique from Tiraspol. It's obvious that the existing negotiation format will not provide for the settlement of this problem. At the same time, the issue is dealing with the format, the stabilization forces and the international monitoring of the Moldovan-Ukrainian border deal with the external dimension of the Transnistrian problem and must be decided without the participation of the anti-constitutional, anti-democratic and the criminal regime for Tiraspol. The settlement model must ensure the sovereignty and the territorial integrity of the Republic of Moldova and provide for an autonomy status for the Transnistrian region as part of the Moldovan state. The armed forces of the Russian Federation, which continue to be illegally stationed on the territory of the Republic of Moldova, are in fact of pressure in the negotiation process and provide for the perpetuation of separatism. The Republic of Moldova call on the Russian Federation to fully withdraw, unconditionally, complete and without delay its armed forces from the Republic of Moldova. The so-called peacekeeping operation presently deployed in the separatist region does not correspond to universal standards of peacekeeping and contributes to the consolidation of the separatist regime. We believe that in this phase of the conflict, it's necessary to deploy a multinational stabilization force in accordance with existing standards. The international monitoring of the Moldovan-Ukrainian border, especially its Transnistrian segment, will constitute a radical contribution to the settlement of the Transnistrian problem by placing the activity in the region economic agents in conformity with the legislation of the Republic of Moldova and our international commitments. Moldova believes that the Transnistrian problem is an issue of regional security and requires a close cooperation, first of all, between the Republic of Moldova and its neighbors, Ukraine and Romania, as well as with the participation of new actors as EU and United States. In the present in Moldova, the Ukrainian initiative on the identification of a solution for Transnistrian problem are studying very carefully. In the same time, any opinion from the international community in this issue are very welcome. In this context, I would like to mention it that democratization is the necessary element which could help to bring in the region the Gonazite values and democratic principles.
We are now into the discussion, so if you allow for others contribute yourself, that's fine. Thank you very much. It's your turn. It's coming.
Thank you. I hope it's on. My name is Oksana Antonenko. I'm from the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. And as a representative of an NGO and also someone who spends a lot of time in separatist regions, I spend a lot of time in South Ossetia, in Abkhazia, in Nagorno-Karabakh, I would just like to say a few words, I think, in the spirit of contribution from a think tank community, NGO society that is present at this meeting. I think what is very important, I think, when we talk about the separatist conflicts, is to understand the societies that live there. We have a lot of representatives here from the NGO community, from Western Europe, from South Caucasus, from Western NIS, but we actually have no one here representing the societies of those regions. And there is no question, of course, that we cannot recognize the legitimacy of separatist regimes. But at the same time, there's lots of people, I think, living for 15 years in the areas of conflict, who actually can provide a very interesting perspective, I think, for all of us to understand how to move forward. And what was said by Boris Tarasyuk about the need for democratization in those societies. It's an absolutely essential precondition for us to move forward, to create a legitimate counterpart on the other side for peace talks, to broaden the horizons of those people who actually have been living for 15 years in isolation, surrounded by crime, surrounded by lawlessness, surrounded by total lack of information about what's going on. We need to invest, and I think NATO also, as well as the European Union, in the major education programs in those regions, in the major information programs in those regions. We need to bring young people from those regions to the West, to give them opportunity to get education, to give them opportunity to understand what democracy is all about. We need to create a constituency there, and we also need to respect the grievances of the society which went through several conflicts and lost lives, lost loved ones. So what I think I would want to support very much, first of all, what was the initiative of Ukraine towards Transnistrian conflict, I think we also have to think about similar initiatives in the South Caucasus. And we also have to find the forum for informal brainstorming discussions which could actually be comprehensive, in which can involve representatives from those regions. And I'm very glad to say that IISS, which I represent, we just started now an informal dialogue in the Georgian-South Ossetian context where we bring representatives both from Georgia and South Ossetia numerous times around the table to have an opportunity for them to talk and arrive to reconciliation. We need to support initiatives like that in Abkhazia. We need to support initiatives like that in Nagorno-Karabakh. And I think if we can find a way to articulate the programs like that, that would be the major contribution of this meeting.
Thank you very much. I would like now to recognize Vladimir Shisov, if you would like to speak. And let me just tell you that I would like this debate to run up to 5-2-1. And then I will invite the participants here to give very, very short comments. But I can't recognize anyone after 5-1.
Спасибо, господин председатель. Я опять позволю себе говорить на своем родном языке, которым, по моему убеждению, свободно владеет здесь больше половины аудитории. Здесь много говорилось о замороженных конфликтах. Нет, это хорошо. Это хорошо, в конце концов. Русский язык является одним из официальных языков и Организации Объединенных Наций, и ОБСЕ, может быть, когда-то будет официальным языком НАТО. Я хотел отметить, что здесь много говорилось о замороженных конфликтах, при этом почему-то Россия упоминалась чаще, чем те страны, где эти конфликты происходят. Но это, видимо, признание роли России в их урегулировании. Хотя оценки давались не всегда корректные и зачастую даже иногда оскорбительные. Я не буду реагировать на последние ремарки такого характера и признателен сэру Брайану Фолу за выражение, видимо, общего подхода западных стран к данной проблеме. Я хотел сказать о другом. Конечно, замороженные конфликты существуют, увы, на евроатлантическом пространстве в достаточном изобилии. Здесь несколько избирательный был подход. Лишь один из выступавших упомянул Кипр, например. Ну, я могу к этому добавить, как классический пример замороженного конфликта, Северную Ирландию. Целый ряд других регионов на евроатлантическом пространстве. Конечно, каждый из этих конфликтов уникален. И каждый из них имеет свой формат урегулирования. А в свое время, я могу признаться, я был автором инициативы обсуждения североирландского регулирования в ОБСЕ. Это не вызвало большого энтузиазма ни у Лондона, ни у Дублина, которые достаточно популярно разъясняли нам и всем присутствующим, что вот действительно конфликт есть, Но есть хорошо себя зарекомендовавший формат его политического регулирования. Я принимаю эту точку зрения. Применительно к Кипру есть хорошо себя зарекомендовавший формат урегулирования в рамках Организации Объединенных Наций с использованием добрых услуг генерального секретаря. Когда же дело доходит до замороженных конфликтов на постсоветском пространстве, то почему-то сложившиеся форматы начинают некоторым не нравиться. Непонятно почему. Да, они, видимо, не идеальны. Были бы они идеальны, сами конфликты были бы, наверное, уже урегулированы. Но эти переговорные форматы выстраданы годами и являются на сегодняшний день, наверное, единственными приемлемыми для всех участников конфликта. Вот о чем, по-моему, участники сегодняшней дискуссии немного забыли, что для политического регулирования требуется политическая воля всех сторон в конфликте. Ни один замороженный или незамороженный конфликт решить давлением извне, решить силой, навязанной извне, невозможно. Любое навязанное решение не будет ни жизнеспособным, ни справедливым. А для этого требуется, в первую очередь, не заниматься, так сказать, рисованием схем возможных форматов новых, а содействовать укреплению доверия между сторонами в каждом конфликте. И вот это второй, так сказать, месседж, вторая мысль, которую я хотел бы выразить. И я думаю, что вот в этом СИАП мог бы наряду с другими международными структурами сыграть свою конструктивную роль. В заключение, я согласен с тем, что сказал Дэн Фрид в отношении, так сказать, такого критерия, как привлекательность государства для его жителей, для всех его жителей, включая проживающих на тех территориях, которые на сегодняшний день не контролируются центральными правительствами. А привлекательность включает в себя много факторов. Это и экономика, безусловно, это и политический режим, это и готовность учитывать интересы и законные права национальных меньшинств, включая право использования своего родного языка в некоторых странах, даже за пределами зон замороженных конфликтов, и многое другое. Вот, очевидно, это тоже должно быть предметом нашего внимания. Спасибо.
Thank you very much, Vladimir, and you, sir, and to be followed by a gentleman with a yellow tie.
Thank you, Temur Yakubashvili, Georgian Foundation for Strategic and International Studies. I want to extend my gratitude to Mr. Karaganov for self-explanatory comments and avoiding my job of naming and shaming. What I want to say that, continuing the pattern that Mr. Fried gave, in those countries that Western engagement was more, we had democratic revolutions. And in those countries that Western engagement was less, we don't have democratic revolution, we had a bloodshed. But I want to remind that those areas are what Russia was considering the nearest abroad or near abroad, and sort of executed this exclusive rights to be a mediator or to be a only country who has some sort of exclusive rights on mediating or conflict resolutions. But I also want to underline that in spite of differences of the conflicts, one thing is in common. All those conflicts that we are referring as a frozen conflict represent today end of secessionist movements in the ex-Soviet territories, because all those regimes are controlled centrally from Moscow. Moscow appoint those people, they are Russian citizens, so we cannot say that these people are striving for independence. In most of the cases, they are appointed from Moscow and governed from Moscow. And I think that it's very important to understand what we are dealing with. And I want to echo what Oksana was saying, that we are disenfranchising those people from any sort of developments that are taking place in our country. And I think it's a task of NATO to be more engaged, and individual members also, more engaged in what Secretary General referred today as shared security perception and values. So if we will have elites in our countries and in all the regions with shared security perceptions, then the conflict resolutions will be much easier. And I think that NATO's task can be, in our part of the world, in Georgia and in other countries, to promote creation of national security communities, which is not only one ministry, even Ministry of Defense or Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but much more people, what media, NGOs, what this forum is also serving for, the creation of those kind of communities. And I believe in those communities we have to incorporate representatives of Abkhazia, Ossetia, Karabakh, Transnistria, and others. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, it's your turn.
Tayvan Pavosyan from Armenian Atlantic Association. I have a question to Mr. Tarasyuk. Mr. Minister, you said that recently Guam country signed a joint agreement about democracy promotion and common approach to conflict resolution. Following from your approach for Transnistria conflict resolution and participation in democracy promotion in that country and your role or proposition that you presented, does it mean that all four countries of Guam are sharing the same view? And, for example, there's a readiness from four of the countries sent a representative, for example, to Nagorno-Karabakh Republic local government election that would be taking in June 19th. Next month. Thank you.
Thank you. And now across the aisle to you, sir.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Nicolae Kirtoac. I'm here at Atlantic Center of Moldova. It's a non-government organization. I would like to start with a rather simple point. We understand in Moldova, after 15 years of unstable situation and my country's desperate need for security guarantees, that, of course, it's necessary to address the Transnistria conflict, understanding the real nature of it. And this is a rather simple understanding from our point of view. It's from the beginning has been territorial and political. Since then, in 15 years, so its development it has another geopolitical dimension with the full involvement of Russian Federation that provides military umbrella as well as economic and political assistance to this separatist regime. And I will very grateful to Mr. Rotfeld. If you remember, 1993, you headed the first CSC mission to Moldova. And you came to the conclusion that this conflict is territorial and political. But since probably mid-90s, it has clear geopolitical dimension, and it means that to be addressed now, it's necessary to have strategic partnership and assistance from international community. And Minister Tarasyuk mentioned it. So, from our point of view, now we have totally different situation and dynamics in a wider Black Sea region, Caspian region, and with emergence with Guam, with assistance of NATO, and based on commonality of long-term interests. Probably there is a totally new reality and potential synergy for the settlement of all these conflicts. And EAPC process probably it's one of the best framework because Guam, of course, needs larger and deeper cooperation with NATO. And I would like to today to congratulate our Azeri and Georgian friends because this is the first then Baku-Jihan pipeline started to work. And we have a big terminal, oil terminal in Moldova that is run for the time being by Azeri Oil Company. This is a wonderful economic long-term basic for cooperation and with raising the profile of Guam as a regional organization dealing as well as with security and the long-term guarantees for independent development of our, well, of member countries. Well, thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. I can just recognize one or two more speakers before we have to wind up, but you, sir, will be the first one. And I know that I have to disappoint some members in of the audience.
Thank you. Dieter Manke, College of Europe, Bruges and Warsaw. In view of the time, let me put a complex question in a simple way. Through most of the statements today, particularly this morning in the plenary session, we talked about democratization, about on-the-ground problems. The Swedish foreign minister mentioned the difficulties of moving from short-term to mid-term and long-term reconstruction, the difficulties of finding out why the families are unhappy, or the Pope's comment that many of the conflicts also had very strong irrational components. All of this leads to the point that you need people. You need personnel to deal with these issues. We're not going to solve these issues through UN resolutions or EU common positions or whatever. You need personnel. You need personnel in a double sense. You need personnel, indigenous personnel, who can determine what is required, who can ask the right questions, who can tell you what is needed, and when they get what is needed, who can then transform this and realize construction and development. On the one hand, you need personnel on the other side, from the EU, from NATO, who can understand these issues, who can deal with the questions, who know something about multicultural communication and so forth, so that together we can do these things. My question to you really is, what are you doing about this? Are these people being trained? And what else do you think we might do in future to achieve this? Thank you.
I can only recognize one more if you have a one-minute intervention. Adam.
Thank you very much. I'm Vera Nanivska from Kyiv, Ukraine. I direct International Center for Policy Studies. My question actually is to Mr. Ambassador, British Ambassador. Sir, I would like to tell you that during Ukrainian Revolution, we have de-Sovietized. That means that our population, the people in the Maidans, decided stop listening to the rubbish of the government, which speaks about democracy and does the opposite. We know about the best democrat in the world, Mr. Stalin, who created the best constitution. Maybe you heard about this. And Western diplomats very often were happy to hear this double talk. Today, Mr. Karaganov explained to us that the best peacekeeping is in prison. And I agree with him. Absolutely. Nowhere else you have the best peacekeeping. The problem is that the citizens of these prisons, of this peace-kept places, do not like that way. And they rather have, they quarrel, they conflict, and they want to have their way, and they want to hear different voices. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now I would like to ask the panel who would need some seconds to comment. Adam, you would like to go first.
Very brief. First of all, I would like to say that one question was very simple and directly addressed to me about the Transnistrian conflict. I would like to say that it seems to me that after listening carefully to that, what Boris Tarasyuk said, it is really an opportunity for the new beginning to resolve the conflict. And we should not miss that opportunity. And I would like to say that that was, by the way, the last sentence in my very brief introduction, that democracy and democratization of Ukraine opened the chance to resolve the conflict in the vicinity of Ukraine. Second, my point is the question what was raised by Minister Vladimir Chizhov. I would like to say that this question I raised for myself many times. Why conflicts like Northern Ireland, Baskeland, Catalonia, Corsica are not within the OSCE? And I will tell you that after a really very, very honest and fair approach, my conclusion is the following, that conflicts could be resolved by international organizations only when it is an added value the democratic countries, they do not need, I would say, that type of added value because they are good enough. And if it is not possible for the United Kingdom to resolve the conflict in Northern Ireland, I do not see really a space for the OSCE with great my respect to the OSCE because, in fact, I devoted a lot of part of my life to promote the OSCE and I know what can be done. But believe me, it is not possible. In many countries, for example, in Transnistria region, it was possible. Not always, but to some extent. In other words, democracy and conflict solution is very much interconnected. And the last point is that both Boris Tarasyuk and many others here, and Oksana Antonienko, Dieter Manke, raised the question that there is a need to, maybe it has to be a kind of the conclusion of this meeting. There is a need to think about the center. I don't know whether it has to be Euro-Atlantic Security Center or Euro-Atlantic Conflict Solution Center, but it seems to me that it would be really important both for governmental and non-governmental institutions to offer some conceptual approach to different conflicts, not one scheme, but simply to assist and to help to find the solution. I'm not thinking about the new theoretical conceptual, I would say, research institute. I have in mind, I would say, something what could be very pragmatical and could help us out to find the solution for the frozen conflicts in Europe. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Who would like to go second? Dan Fried, perhaps?
I agree with Daniel Rotfeld in his point. In addressing Minister Chizov's concern, why the OSCE hasn't taken the lead in Northern Ireland, and it's because developed democracies are handling the situation. I don't think there is a question of as much value added, but that is in any rate a largely polemical point. I think the key now is to recognize the relationship between democracy and reforms on the one hand and the solution to the frozen conflicts on the other. It is true that the new democratic governments in Georgia and Ukraine have opened the way to solutions in Transnistria and South Ossetia in ways that were not possible before. So if democracy taken the wrong way leads to nationalism and separatist conflicts, democracy taken the right way and with the right kind of leadership opens the way to solutions to these conflicts. That's what we need to do, and not argue about the theory of the OSCE east of Vienna, west of Vienna, the OSCE, the EU, NATO, EAPC, and of course Russia is a member of EAPC and a member of the OSCE. Those are the institutions which should, when there is value added to be had, engage themselves. And I think it's our intention, certainly my government's intention, to do as much as it can in that respect.
Thank you very much, Boris.
Thank you. There were two questions addressed to me. Whether all countries of Guam share the Ukrainian proposal concerning the settlement in Transnistria. During the Guam summit, there were, in principle, positive comments made by the presidents of Guam countries. At the same time, they were commenting the seven steps disclosed by President Yushchenko. Seven steps, this is just the brief description of the whole plan. The whole plan became the subject of thorough study later. And to the best of my knowledge, all Guam countries do support Ukrainian proposals. And I was surprised at hearing from the distinguished representative of Moldova that the proposals are still being studied. From reliable Moldovan sources, I claim to say that the study is over and the proposals were supported. As to Karabakh, the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh was not thoroughly discussed at the recent summit of Guam, but I would like to assure you that it will be discussed during the forthcoming ministerial Guam meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sergei.
Thank you. A few remarks. First, U.S. role, Sir Brian, European Union role is not weird, it's kinky. I mean, if European Union wants to get itself involved, let it get ideas, people, and money. So far, none, I mean... Yes, I mean, so far, only words. Not in the conflicts except for Kosovo, Macedonia, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
But in Abkhazia, I mean, a little bit. Second, so I'm the most generous towards Georgia, and I think that they're... I'm a leader of the party in Russia who thinks that the only way to solve the problems of breakaway states is to help Georgia to prosper. And I third, Chechnya is in a different category simply because Russia had... the will and the ability to fight and to kill, and I don't want this issue to be be the customary to be a custom. Fourth, Kosovo is a key state, I reiterate. If Kosovo is acknowledged as a state, independent state, then all others will have the right. And some will be independent sooner or later, whether we want it or not. The last, we have stop quarreling and understand that we are indeed united in Europe. I mean, we are still competing, which is a pity. I do not want to even to quarrel with a Socorian view of the world, because it's, from my point, is irrelevant. But we have to be united. Otherwise, we are in for trouble. And these tiny problems which we have on our hands now are very small.
Thank you. Now, Giorgio Barmitze for a quick remark. Please.
Thank you very much. Thank you for all my colleagues for really very interesting and the participants very interesting and frank discussions. I have to refer to the, first of all, Oksana Antonenko's remarks about giving the possibility the local people living in the secessionist regions, not states, regions, to have elected or chosen their own leaders. But we are trying to have this process, but there is a major power influential in that regions, which is not willing to do that. That's what, and this is the Russia. And we know that in South Ossetia we have appointed so-called leader there locally, and recently in so-called elections in Abkhazia without majority of the population, which was sort of kicked out from Abkhazia, even those people who are currently living in Abkhazia were not allowed to have elected their leader without serious interference. So that we are dealing right now with Russia and with Russia's interests to really have settled these conflicts or not. But we believe this is in Russia's best interest to have
united Georgia and really democratic and prosperous Georgia, where human rights are protected, rule of law is safeguarded, and where all people have opportunity to live in prosperous country, in free country, and do a business and achieve whatever they want to achieve in this world. This is our goal, actually. Very simple. If we apply this to Abkhazia concretely, we want to let refugees, majority of the population, including those Abkhazians, ethnic Abkhazians, who were opposing idea of separatists, go back, have a election, democratic, really democratic election, and then they will choose what they want to do. So that's the very simple, as simple as it is. So that's what we want. But in order to achieve this, we want to persuade our great neighbor of Russia to agree with the simple idea that it's good to have the stability in its southern flank rather than have destabilization. So this is the point, and it's good to have a democratic neighbor and a neighbor of NATO member or EU member eventually, which will contribute to Russia's well-being as well, because we will have then possibility to have greater economical relationship, increase this relationship, and use this tremendous potential of this region to make people be happier. That's the point. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now let me, guess you have to be very, very quick, if I may suggest that. Even if you have a lot to comment on.
Two normative points by way of conclusion. First, settlements need to be based on aspirations of regional countries and of Euro-Atlantic interests, not on the Russian or Soviet past. What Russia is proposing is to preserve the Russian imperial and Soviet past through unresolved conflicts or through settlements in conformity with the legacies of the past. This partly explains the insistence on preserving the, quote, existing formats, unquote, which are part of a different historic stage. Those frameworks ensure multiple representation of Russian interests, directly or indirectly, while excluding any direct Western representation. This is why the so-called existing formats need to be cast aside. It's not necessary to proclaim their dissolution or their cessation. They could easily be circumvented or allowed to die a natural death by transferring the substantive negotiations to those parties that are interested in a future-oriented European-type settlement. That's the first point. And the second point has to do with the proper definition of interests. Euro-Atlantic interests in the region require strong, secure, economically successful partner states. Euro-Atlantic interests are synonymous with nation-building interests in this region. They are twin sides of one and the same set of interests. And this is the vision that must guide conflict settlement efforts. Thank you.
Well, thank you, all of you. I think it's not my job to sum up, and in a way it would be rather difficult. We were reminded at the outset that all these conflicts are different. But on the other hand, we were also reminded that the democratization and the reform process is certainly creating new opportunities, and I think we really should have put an emphasis on this. I absolutely agree with what Boris said, that it is not possible to solve this conflict without international contributions. But on the other hand, we should remind ourselves that with a real political will from the parties themselves, it will be impossible to reach a solution. We have international mechanisms. I'm not going to comment on whether they are adequate or not. But certainly, we
should continue to address these very difficult issues within the present format of the EAPC, and certainly there are we need increased involvement from allies and partners. I would like to thank the speakers, thank the discussants, thank all of you who have made a contribution, and all of you who came here to listen to the discussions. Thank you very much, all of you. Thank you.